We are continuing our discussions with Advocate Debbie Ainslie about different aspects of South African law. Today we will be discussing civil law, and the first question I'm going to ask Debbie is to just position civil law versus other branches of the law without going into too much detail about the other branches.
Okay, well, civil law is a dispute between two parties where they are going to the court for resolution of that dispute, for a ruling on that dispute. Now, often it is to do with interpretation of a contract or an interpretation of who's got what rights, and sometimes it's the interpretation of actual legislation. And it's two parties arguing with each other and going to the courts as a independent adjudicator on their issue. So that issue could be when we were all happy and friends, we agreed on a contract, and now we are in dispute about what has happened since then, and we now want a court to resolve the issue for us. That will be a civil matter.
And that is different from a criminal matter where someone has committed a crime. In this case, people are just arguing about something. And give us examples of, just a couple of examples of what the dispute might be about.
Okay, so for example, a contract, it would be I said I was going to deliver 25 pairs of shoes to you and you were going to pay me within 30 days. I delivered, according to you, 24 pairs of good shoes, one pair of bad shoes, and you want to pay me for 24 pairs, and I'm saying that you need to pay me for the full 25 pairs of shoes. That would be a typical dispute on contract. Now, if it is we both agree that the 25th pair of shoes is faulty, then it's really, am I paying for the faulty shoes, or do I get a discount for the faulty shoes? Or, and I'm using an oversimplified example, obviously.
Sure.
But if we're disputing whether that 25th pair of shoes was delivered at all, then it would be going to evidence on a trial, and you'd be calling witnesses, and the court's deciding who's the most credible. If you're in agreement on the state of the shoes and that it was delivered, but you don't know who's right in the law about whether that 25th pair needs to be paid for or not, then you would go on application, and where your evidence is given on affidavit. And that would be in motion court and application procedure. Other examples would be it might have a basis in contract that I've contracted to rent your house and now I haven't paid rent. So there might be a trial regarding outstanding rentals if there's a dispute of what I have paid. But you might also, as the owner of the property, you have to, because there's legislation that provides, you have to go to court to get the court's permission to evict me. If you don't do that, you're taking the law into your own hands, and I can go to court and get a spoliation, which restores me to the property, and you can't kick me out until you've got a court order, because we've got legislation that is around that. You might, for example, have said on Facebook that I'm a ignorant, lying cheat, and that I think has defamed my good reputation, and I take you to court to say that you can't say that. I could take you to court, for example, to get an interdict to prevent you from saying that and take that down, or I could be taking you to court to pay me damages for the harm you've done to my reputation. So it's enforcement of rights. It's a declarator of rights often. If you think of getting divorced, you've got for example, an antenuptial contract, fine. But what assets are comprised in your estate, and you might have a dispute about that. You might be trying to hide something behind a trust. So does the court say, okay, you've been treating this trust as your own personal money? The court rules on that, whether it gets included in the divorce or not. As far as children, the High Court is the upper guardian of all children, and if you two can't agree on what's in the best interests of the children, the court decides that.
Okay, so a lot of things can result in a dispute in court, and I'm thinking small. I'm thinking something like 20,000 or 30,000 rand as part of a contract. There is a small claims court, and what is the cutoff of the small claims court? Number one, and number two, do you need a lawyer to go to the small claims court?
Okay, so small claims court cutoff has just recently gone up to 20,000 rand. It does not apply to companies, so it's for individuals. So I've lent Sam 21,000 rand, and Sam hasn't paid back, and he'd also agreed to pay interest. Then 20,000 is my limit. So I've got to decide if I'm going to go to small claims court on my own. I do not need a lawyer. In fact, I cannot have a lawyer in small claims court. I can either say I'm going to lose the extra 1,000 plus the interest and go and get an order immediately for the 20,000, or I can choose to go to a district court and say I want the 21 plus interest plus legal fees or whatever. But small claims court is for those smaller amounts, and you can go and represent yourself. You go to the small claims court, they tell you how to do a letter of demand. You've got to prove that you've sent the letter of demand, and then you get the documents for court, and you send it to the other, you give it to the other side. You've got to prove that you did give it to them. They've then got to come to court if they've got any defense. If they haven't, then the order is made, and that is as binding as in any other court in the nation. And then to collect it, you can go to the sheriff. The sheriff can execute against movables. If there's not enough movables to cover it, it can go even to immovables or against your pension, or get a garnishing order against a salary. Or you can go to what's called Section 65 court, where they say, okay, well, what can you afford? And then you've got to take all your documents, prove what you can afford, and then the court orders that that's the amount that has to be paid monthly until the debt is extinguished.
Okay. You mentioned small claims court, and you mentioned district court. Now, that makes me ask the question, what are the levels of court? We've got a small claims court, we got a district court, we got the High Court.
In between that is between the district court, which is a magistrate's court in the districts. You have then a regional court, which is also a magistrate's court. That's in geographically will cover a larger area than the district. So the idea is accessibility. So you can go for smaller claims. You get the small claims court, which can be at a court, or it can be even in a building. There's lots of them. And then there's the district court, which is within a district. A regional court covers all the courts that are in that district, and then you get the High Court, which is they're few and far between. Okay, so the district court is for claims up to 200,000 rand. The regional court is between 200 and 400,000, and then anything above 400,000 you will go to the High Court for.
Okay. The lawyers that would be representing you in these different courts, are they advocates or the attorneys or both?
Okay, so generally in the district court and the regional court, you can be represented by an attorney who stands up and speaks in court, even a Canada attorney in the district courts. And then in the High Court is generally advocates. Now I say generally both for both instances, because there's no restriction on an advocate appearing in either district, regional court and then the High Court. Traditionally advocates appear in the High Court, and in long ago days, it used to be that they could only appear in the High Court, but now they can appear in any court. And likewise, where previously an attorney was only allowed to appear in the lower courts, they now can get right of appearance after a certain number of years. I think it's 3 years of practicing in good standing as attorneys. They can get a right of appearance in a High Court. And attorneys do appear for the more simple matters in the High Court. Generally, you would get an advocate when a matter is more complicated.
Okay, so from that I read that the differential between attorneys and advocates is busy merging. Am I right?
Yes, indeed. Since the Legal Practice Act, when it was a bill, they wanted to do away with the referral system entirely. And we are no longer legally referred to as attorneys or advocates other than we are called legal practitioners. But an attorney has a different qualification set, different exams, and different, they've got to do articles for 2 years, during which time they get paid. An advocate does pupillage if they're going to be a member of the bar. Now, what the Legal Practice Act introduced as well is that an advocate can be a trust account advocate. That the Bar Council still doesn't allow us to be trust account advocates. So the Bar Council is a voluntary association underneath the Legal Practice Council. And the Legal Practice Council distinguishes between trust advocates and non-trust advocates, being a member of the bar and other independent advocates. So the distinction between the different types of legal practitioners is changing. However, advocates who are members of the bar still only are referral work. So the only customers we have, the only clients we have, is the attorney who briefs us, and that is because we're litigation specialists. So we don't see the public, we don't deal directly with the public. You can't come knock on our door and come to us. And the idea is behind it is that we get to specialize in litigation. We give opinions and we do litigation, whether it's trial or motion court practices, and we don't have to and I'm putting air quotes here, waste our time with doing admin and filing of notices and those things. We just specialize in the actual legal proceedings, in the litigation. So there are some attorneys who do a lot of litigation, and there's some attorneys, surprisingly, who do almost no litigation. That if they have any litigation at all, they will go to an advocate. If they even suspect litigation is required, they will go to an advocate immediately, or even pass their client on to a firm who does litigation.
Okay. We're diverting a little from the subject of civil law, but I just want to complete this question. Attorneys can be part of a firm, and advocates operate individually, am I correct?
Correct, yes, yeah.
So you don't have a firm of advocates, you have firms of attorneys, but advocates are sole practitioners.
Correct.
And you can't be part of a firm.
Correct.
Okay. Let's get back to civil law. We talked about, civil law kind of overlaps here with law of contract, and I would imagine common law and law of property and a few others.
Yes.
So yes. You can enter into a civil suit for common law issues, law of property. You talked about rights of servitudes and things like that, which may not be part of a contract but part of common law.
Yes, in fact, it's any dispute where two parties are in dispute with each other, without the power of the state, and I spoke about on the last podcast about what is criminal law. And criminal law is when somebody has broken the law and the state steps in to enforce the laws of the country. And yet the state can also act be a party in a civil litigation. For example, if you get awarded a tender, you do the work and the state doesn't pay you, you can sue the state. And that it also would also be civil. And then I must also just pause to mention that where sometimes the state says, I'm not going to prosecute a crime. And this has happened, when it does, it seems to be make news and make the newspapers and so on. The state will say, we do not have enough evidence to be able to successfully prosecute a crime, say now a kidnapping charge. And then the National Prosecuting Authority, in the form of the National Director of Public Prosecutions, issues a certificate that says, we are not going to prosecute for this crime. Then a private individual can still prosecute. As long as the state has said they're not going to do that, a private individual can take on the burden of the state to prosecute a criminal matter. And although the matter remains criminal, it has the appearance of a civil matter because it's two individual parties. The standard of proof remains as it would in a criminal matter, which is a much higher standard of proof, but that is the exception to when the state is acting with the state power to enforce its laws, that a private individual can do. And then in civil matters, the state can be sued and does also sue, not with the state power of enforcing criminal penalties and for breaking the law, but where there's a dispute regarding money or rights or something like that.
Okay, you mentioned burden of proof. There's a difference between criminal burden of proof, which is beyond reasonable doubt.
Yep.
And in a civil case, it would be balance of probabilities.
Correct.
Correct.
Yes.
So it would probably be easier to get resolution on a civil suit in the kind of matter you just discussed.
The burden of proof in a civil suit is when you're acting, the state is not acting with the authority of the state. The burden of proof is on the balance of probabilities, but it's entirely different claim. Whereas the one you're looking for, an incarceration or a punishment or a fine or whatever, in a civil suit, you're trying to vindicate a right you thought you had, or enforcement of the terms of a contract, or people don't get... Typically, there are exceptions, and we can talk about that, contempt of court and such. But you typically are not going to be locked up in a civil matter. It might cost you money. You might have to keep quiet. You might have to issue an apology. You might lose your house. You might lose your right to live in a house that isn't yours. But you're not typically going to jail, and that's why the burden of proof. It's not your freedom. And remember, in previous days, a criminal matter, the most severe penalty was death. You could be hung you could be hanged the death penalty was the ultimate. Although we don't have the death penalty anymore, that is never a consideration in a civil matter at all. You're not going to lose your freedom and you're not going to lose your life. So that's why the standard of proof is different. And also in the civil matters, you've got two parties who are knocking heads. You haven't got the one party being the state with all the power of this and the resources of a state. And that's why it's equal. It's much closer. It's just on the balance of the probabilities, which is more likely than not. And then there's obviously all the gatekeeping to determine what those probabilities are. So there's rules of evidence. What evidence is allowed in? What is best evidence? What is hearsay evidence? Are you allowed to have hearsay evidence? How do you judge credibility. So what I was speaking about earlier is you can have a dispute regarding what is the interpretation of law, or you could have a dispute about the facts. And if a dispute about facts, it goes to oral evidence, and it's the court who looks at the credibility of the witnesses and says which one is more likely to be telling the truth and to get to the truth that way. Because you're always looking for the truth in matters in court.
Yep. And also who, when you're in a contract, I don't know how to put this, but it's who's got, who is correct in terms of their interpretation of the contract.
Yeah. Okay. So whose interpretation of the contract is correct? And there's obviously a whole lot of law around how do you interpret a contract? Who does it, you know, if you wrote up the contract, then that counts against you. How did the parties behave in the duration of the contract, as if that clause was this, or did they? They also, and it would be a slightly different kettle of fish, but were there misrepresentations made? And often the contracts that we sign these days are so complex because all of that litigation that's come before is now included in a contract. So, for example, if you read a contract and it says the gender, if it says he, or it means he or she or whatever, and that's because somewhere in a contract, you know, 50 years ago it said he, and actually the person signing it was a she, so it's like this contract doesn't apply to me because I'm not a man. And so we put these phrases that have been used as defenses in the past, and we the contracts have developed to incorporate all of them. So often you'll read a contract and think, why is this in here? You know, what does a day mean? Why do we need to know what a day means? Well, does a day mean if I give you notice that you're in default and I say you've got 7 days notice, does that mean I've got 7 working days notice to fix it? Does it mean it's 7 calendar days? If you tell me on Friday, does Saturday and Sunday include that? If you tell me on Friday and it only is work days, does that mean I have until the next week, so the 5 days, does Friday count, or does Monday, you only start counting on Monday? So those things that have slipped people up in previous litigation now get all incorporated into the future contracts, so that you're trying to close the possibilities of dispute. And remember, with a contract, you're writing that contract when everything is hunky-dory, when you're keen and excited and people think, oh no, we'll work well together. You write a contract so that when things fall apart, or if things fall apart, or if there's a disagreement, you can go back to the contract and say, but this is what we agreed. Now, mostly contracts where an arrangement between parties falls apart, the contract is the solution and it never gets to litigation. The litigation comes in only where the parties have different interpretations of what was meant in the contract.
Okay, but you are still, once you sign a contract, you are presumed to have read every one of those complex clauses. And you can't get away by saying this, I didn't understand this.
Generally, you definitely can't.
Okay.
So there's been a couple of exceptions to that. We've got legislation that guides a lot of this. So we've got the Consumer Protection Act, we've got the National Credit Act, and as litigation has gone around that, around with those acts, so we've got a contract, but they bound to those provisions of that legislation. Then it will be, but how could this person understand this? So they've marked their signature with a thumbprint or an X because they couldn't write. So what was the duty to explain the contents of the contract? So you now go rent a car and suddenly you find that there's bright red blocks around things, and that's because they lost litigation before, because it was that wasn't pointed out to the person, that clause in the contract wasn't pointed out, and so it made that the person couldn't be bound to it. So then there's now the expectation that difficult clauses will also be explained. but the risk is still yours. If you sign a document, you are bound by what you signed generally, and it's only in exceptional circumstances that you can get behind that, get around that. And the favorite one I hear is duress. I was under duress and I only signed that because I had to. And yes, there's an absolute defense of duress, but it means that you or somebody you loved in your family was in danger of being killed, kind of thing. That's what duress is. I mean, the fact that you were being told, oh, you're not a nice man if you don't sign this, is not quite duress. So I often have clients coming in saying it was duress, but that don't meet the definition of duress, and then they're just bound by their own signatures. But having said all of that, the reason for the Consumer Protection Act and the National Credit Act and even Divorce Act and that is justice. That's what we're trying to achieve. So you cannot sign away, for example, that this person is allowed to kick me out of this house at any moment. If I say something wrong, they can kick me out of the house that they own because they don't like my face anymore. Or if I put on 20 kilograms, this person is, that's against public mores. That's against what is acceptable, which is a shifting thing over decades. But you can't sign away that right. So because the law gives you that right. So if you sign that clause, that document, that clause is unenforceable. And that's why you have the funny little clause that comes into contracts, that if one clause is not enforceable, that it doesn't cancel the entire contract. We even find that in old wills and things, a lot of the universities, there was litigation, whereas people had said in their will they're donating to the university for bursaries for white men, for example. And that was a norm. That was an acceptable norm in previous years. Now there's litigation to say that that is against the public policy, existing public policy, so that that portion of the of a very old will can be ignored, and the bursary can apply to women as well. Or and sometimes it is like this bursary is only for Jewish women, and then that's like that still can be upheld, for example, because there was a religious belief for this person, and it's not against the norms of society. So norms of society in interpretation actually play a role as well.
Well, this kind of makes me think of modern South Africa, where I cannot offer a bursary for white men only, but can I offer a bursary for black underprivileged children?
Yes, and you can offer a bursary for white men only, but it would have to be qualified furthermore, you know, I mean, with a bit more detail. It's distinguishing on race alone requires more proof of why it's not just discriminatory. So if you say, I am writing this will because my child was handicapped and was never able to go to university, I am white, and I want the people who were friends to my son who wasn't able to go to university to be able to go to university, and I'm creating this, that's no problem.
Okay, well, that's probably a totally different subject.
But can I also just, we spoke about the courts and the civil courts and about enforcing rights, whether it's contract and whether it's money and, you know, divorces. And there's also other courts. So on the same on the criminal matters, we've got the Commercial Crimes Court, and that we have. Under civil matters, we've got Land Claims Court, we've got Labor Court, we've got Equality Court, the Chapter 9 institutions that you know, you can go to the Equality Court. Obviously, you can see what prompted this connection of this thought. For example, there's a matter recently I was asked just advice on, where an autistic child is screaming and making noise, and the body corporate is fining the person. Is the parents of this person, of this child who is autistic and not controllable, is this a fair thing? So we've got a community service ombudsman, we've got an equality court, we aren't allowed to distinguish or disadvantage somebody because of a handicap, basically. I'm not finding the right words, but so if you go to Equality Court, can they overturn the fines that have been issued by the body corporate? Can they prevent the body corporate? Is that actually an act of inequality by penalizing the parents of an autistic child? Or do you go to the community services ombudsman and say, look, these people keep complaining, so the body corp keeps fining us, this is what our child does? Do we have to get to a point where we say this child can't live in a block of flats because of the noise? So those are different courts that you can go to and different forums. So we have, if you got a complaint against a legal practitioner, we now have an ombudsman. If you have an insurance claim and the insurance company refuses it, before you even get to court, you go to the ombudsman and say, this is the issue, and the ombudsman makes a ruling. If you don't like it, you can, you know, then you can take it on appeal or review to court. If you don't like the outcome of it, we can also, a lot of civil matters are resolved in arbitration, and we have qualified arbitrators and arbitration organizations where you pay an arbitrator to listen to your case and to make a decision about who's right or wrong. You cannot do divorces. The Arbitration Act excludes divorces from its purview. But if you have a dispute between, for example, two construction companies, or a construction company and the organization that they're building the shopping center for, and they don't want all the details in public, because that's what a court does, everything that's in before the court is in before the public, you can go to arbitration where that is kept private. It's a more costly way, because obviously we don't pay for judges, you don't pay for your matter to be in court to be heard by a judge, where you do pay but for an arbitrator, but it's not made public. And it's enforceable through the courts. That arbitration award is enforceable through the court, and you still, and you can possibly get it done sooner than going to court. Okay, so those are just some of the other things I needed to talk about.
Yeah, you preempted a question that was in my mind, which was, in many contracts you see a clause that says we both agree to arbitration by a certain body, or just by arbitration. Is that?
Yes. And if you try and sue, and you've agreed in a contract to an arbitration clause, and then you try to go to court on that, the court doesn't have jurisdiction until the arbitration is done. So unless both parties agree to waive the arbitration, if one party enforces it, then it has to go to arbitration first. And you generally will agree to which arbitration company or which arbitrator that is going to be heard. The other thing that I must mention is that the court rules now include that you have to stay for every litigation, you have to state whether it is possible to go to mediation or not. And that is not just family law. That is in all litigation. Rule 41A says, is this matter capable of being resolved through mediation? And you try mediation before you go to court. Unless you say it can't. And then if you refuse to go to mediation, when it comes to the court granting costs orders, it might say, well, this was capable of mediation, so you got to pay the costs. Because the awarding of costs normally goes to the winner of the litigation, normally gets their costs paid. Get an order for their costs paid. There are exceptions to that, and it doesn't cover all your costs, because litigation is nightmarishly expensive. And we can also talk about how you can get to litigation when you don't have the money other than small claims court. But your normal scale of paying is party and party costs, which means it's only the costs of the actual drafting of papers for court and the appearance in court, whether it's attorney or advocate, and not all of those hundreds of phone calls that go in between, and that's not covered. If it's attorney-client costs, then the number of events or actions taken during the litigation more are covered. And generally, a court will say that costs are ordered. If I've won the litigation, then my side will be able to claim from the other side. My client will be able to claim from the other side part of the costs. It goes to a taxing master, or you can do it as it agreed. And except when you are trying to enforce a human right, then there's a principle that was set out in a case called BioWatch, where the court doesn't penalize you by, even if you lose a case, with a costs order, because you were trying to vindicate your own rights, normally human rights, and normally those are in the higher courts. But it's to assist the person who's trying to vindicate their Chapter 2 human rights. Don't get costs orders so as to not discourage people from doing so, for trying to get, you know, establish their rights.
Well, we covered a lot of ground, and basically civil law, cases are about between two parties, and it is either breaking a common law or an established norm, or it's a contract.
Yeah, or I must mention also, because of all the protections of litigation, of legislation, we used to be able to, if you bought a house from the bank used to be able to sell it out from under you if you hadn't kept up with your bond payment. That decision has to go to the court now. The court sets a reserve price on the auction because there were these syndicates that would buy a house for, like, you know, 10,000 rand, sell it the next day for 1.2 million, and then you still owed the debt to the bank, and so on. So there's every single bank issue to do with housing, if it's your primary residence or if it's a home, if it's a resident, has to go before the court, and the court does all these checking things. That's a civil case still. If you any agreement through a car purchase now, and this is recent, it used to be done by the master's office, it's now has to go to court as well. So the court, if you look at a typical court roll, it will have tons of banking matters on. It will have RAF matters on because the court has to supervise all of those. The RAF, just being the Road Accident Fund, doesn't reply to a claim, and it has to do so because there's another act, PARJA Act, that says government has to make decisions, or government organs of state have to make decisions, you know, within a reasonable time. And if it's not done, you can take them to court and take that their decision. If you don't like the decision, you can take it on review. Or if they don't make a decision, that is a decision. If it's not made within a reasonable time, you take it to court, and the court directs them to make that decision. So all of that even falls under civil. So the difference between civil and criminal is really, and it also can be many parties. So the main difference is that criminal is the state acting with state power to enforce its laws, and for the benefit of society. And in civil, you've got private parties, even if that party is the state that you're suing or you're being sued by, it's not with state power. It's not prosecuting a crime. It is a dispute between parties who are officially, you might not be on the same level, but there's not one acting with authority of the state. And I must also just come back to this point. We keep talking about just two parties, but I've had matters where there are five applicants and 14 respondents, where it's the dispute is actually much bigger than just two parties. I've done matter before where the people I have sued is the Department of Social Development, the Department of Health, and the Department of Education because of a child falling through the cracks and not being cared for. It can be that I've got one where there are 55 applicants, which is a community, and we'd originally gone in as a community on an application. We got an interim order where stopping the municipality from destroying homes, that's now going to trial. The municipality wanted to identify only certain people in that community, and so they've identified 55 people or something like that, and that's going to trial because the court said it couldn't decide on the papers because there was a dispute of fact, which we didn't anticipate, and so it's been referred to trial where everyone will give evidence and then it will be decided. And in that case it's the state, but it's the local government and one other. So it's not always just one on one. The complexities can get larger.
Wow, okay. Well, I think you've outlined it as much as we can in this podcast, because there's a lot around it, but still, I think you've clarified what is a civil case, and I think that's the most important thing that we wanted to establish today.
Good.
I don't know if there's anything else you want to add.
I do want to add one thing, and I touched on it briefly just now, was just on the cost of litigation. We have a system where you can get assistance for litigation when you don't have sufficient money, and the universities have law clinics, there's Legal Aid Board, there's Justice Centre, there is a wonderful organisation called probono.org, and they all work on exactly the same requirements, because that is a requirement set down by the state, and unfortunately it's very, very low. So you've got to have assets less than a certain amount, and I think that's 1 million. So you can't, you know, if you have a house that's got equity more than that, and your salary has got to be less than 14,000, then you get you can get assistance in litigation to sue somebody else, and that could be anything from landlords to divorces to a human rights violation or a disability or SASA grant or getting an ID book or any of those things. In my view, litigation is still not affordable for a large swath of people after that earn too much to fit into that category of qualifying for pro bono services, but still can't afford. There is a lot of people will act on contingency. So if it's a medical negligence case or something like that, attorneys and counsel will often act on contingency, is if they win this case and you get an award, then they will take a percentage. And what that percentage is and how that is structured is all regulated by legislation as well, the Contingency Act, so that people can still get to litigate even though they don't have money to do so. A lot of RAF matters, a lot of unlawful arrests, a lot of medical negligence matters are done on contingency in that way. And then also, if it's a violation of rights, even if you don't qualify underneath that very narrow financial window, there are a number of organizations who will take up your case. Equal Education comes to mind, Center for Child Law, and then Bar Council. Every single Bar Council, for example, has a pro bono committee where if you need to get assistance, you can approach them. And then the courts themselves also have a system where you can go and get approach the court to ask for free representation, and the court then decides whether your matter's got any merits and will then approach whichever the bar counsel and or the legal practice counsel to get you assistance, or just phone an attorney they know and trust and say, please assist this person. And so just while it's prohibitive, the cost is prohibitive, there are many avenues to try and get assistance without having to spend a fortune.
Well, that's encouraging. We've touched on pro bono before, and I just wanted to ask you, do attorneys and advocates and other legal representatives have a quota for pro bono? Are you required to do a certain number of pro bono cases a year?
Yeah, it's I don't know what the attorneys are required to do, but advocates are required to do 40 hours per year in terms of the Legal Practice Act, and the Legal Practice Council set down 40 hours. Most of the people I know do more than that, and that's just 1 week a year. But and you can also do, you know, if you're working on the for the Bar Council or you're doing lecturing or something, it can be offset. But yeah, the minimum is 40, and that you've got to report when you've done free work, pro bono work.
Okay, I imagine an advocate starting out will probably want to build their reputation through pro bono first, because you.
Great minds think alike.
it's about the only way you're going to get your name out there, isn't it?
I absolutely encourage pupils to do this. I lecture ethics to pupils at the Durban Bar, and I absolutely encourage it. I had worked as a manager for the Rhodes Law Clinic before I started studying law. And obviously that is an entire operation that is funded by donors and to help people. It's one of the places where you can go and get pro bono services. And so I felt quite strongly about it. And in my first year, and I have to admit that I have continued to do so, I did over 200 hours in my first year. And they're definitely... got work from attorneys who saw me arguing pro bono matters in court. So I gained exposure and experience by doing pro bono work, lot of pro bono work in my first few years, and most importantly, felt good about myself. So.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Okay. Anything else from your side?
All done. I'm good. Thanks, Henk.
Okay. I think it was a very good session. I'm going
Thank
to
you.
Stop the recording now.
Okay. Stop.